Good evening. It's such an honor to speak at the Saturday Night Live meeting. I use they, them pronouns, and I'm a recovering stoner. It's exciting to speak. I was a little nervous to speak at a meeting that I haven't been to before, and I go to meetings just about every day, sometimes more than once a day, even now, 3 years, 2 months, and 3 days into, I guess my recovery's been longer than that, but I've been free of weed now 3 years and some change. I just celebrated on Thursday my 40th birthday, and a few days before that, 1 year on gender-affirming hormones, so I take testosterone. And so even though I was nervous to speak at a new meeting, I thought, you know what, it's an auspicious time and I ought to just do it. And I also go almost exclusively to queer meetings. And I know that's not here, but I'm glad to be here. So I grew up, I grew up in a rural community, a small town in Southern California that was a grow community. And so stoner identity and being around reefer was always part of the culture. I remember when I first moved to New York, I live now in the Hudson Valley, occupied Haudenosaunee territory. And when I moved out to the East Coast, I remember someone asking me, like, have you ever done pot? And it struck me as so silly because that pot wasn't even a drug, you know, where I grew up and in the culture in which I grew up. I was a latchkey kid. I had one of my parents was around all the time physically, but was emotionally sort of unavailable. And my other parent, my dad was an alcoholic, was really emotionally present with me when he was around, but he was very in and out. And I realized now in looking back at my addiction that I had some invisibility problems really into my late adulthood. In any event, I left my small rural community, which, by the way, was extremely conservative, bordered on a military base. It was the Pala Reservation, indigenous reservation on one side, and the military base on the other, Camp Pendleton, and an ammunition weapon station. So you can kind of imagine a strange strange place for a queer trans Jewish kid, no less, to grow up. In any event, I left to sort of make it in the big city, and my dad died in my early 20s, and that was in my final year of college, and that's when I started smoking weed pretty much every day. I remember I had never gone to class high until, you know, that big loss in my life. And I didn't really have any vocabulary for grief. And, you know, I was surrounded by a bunch of entitled college students. You know, I blessed my friends at the time, and I'm grateful for everything they did to me. But I have a very vivid memory of every time I would begin to cry or show emotion, you know, I was just handed a bong. And or a joint, or that was just how my best friend even just sort of handled that, and I just went with it, you know. And that was kind of me, right? I just went with it, or I wanted to be easygoing, or I was the easy child, you know. I was a very high achieving kid. my brother was the one with all the problems, right? Growing up, I can hear my mom's voice kind of saying that, oh, your brother is the problem child, you know, you're the easy one. And so I did everything I was told and eventually somehow made my way all the way to law school. And I think that was probably the longest time that I had not gotten high was probably the first couple of months of law school when I had just moved. I had gone back to Southern California, and I had moved from Southern California back to the East Coast for law school eventually. And those first couple of months when I was getting settled and I lived in a dorm on the law school campus, that was maybe about 3 months it took me before I, you know, found a supply and found a way to get off campus and try to get high. And then these were the days too before there were vapes and stuff, but there were, you know, I was on the cutting edge of technology, if you will. I definitely found a way to get one of the very first, you know, it wasn't called a vape, I forget what it was called at the time, but it had like a USB charger. I mean, just goofy stuff, just went to real goofy lengths to start getting high again. Once I figured out how to do that, I was off to the races again, and somehow I was hired before I graduated, and I started working immediately as a public defender in New York City. So that's a lawyer for folks below the poverty line who are accused of a crime. And I worked in Brooklyn, which is one of the oldest criminal courthouses. And sort of for an attorney job, you know, it's like being in the belly of the beast. I saw so much violence, generally perpetrated by the police, and these really oppressive systems in which I was working. And by then, I was getting high. You know, I'd wake up sometimes in the middle of the night. I told myself that pot helped me sleep. I'll be honest, if there would be one thing that I could say to myself now, that to myself in my early days of getting off weed, would be, you're going to sleep better and more soundly, and falling asleep will eventually be just easier and better and more glorious than it has ever been before. I wish I could tell myself that. Would have been such a comfort. So whatever it's worth. So I'd get up in the middle of the night. I'd smoke in the middle of the night. I'd wake up extra early so I could get high, you know, time it just right to get on the subway, hear all the noises and the just the dense human interaction that at the time was just almost unbearable for me. People in your space, different smells, you know, all the smells of city living, all these things that were really sort of assaultive to my sensitive nervous system, you know. And I thought, I used to call pot my bubble wrap, you know, that I was quite literally, it felt like I was insulating myself. I know very clearly, I remember, you know, one time I ran out of my supply again before the days of just being able to go on to a mass marketing text message and like order online and have delivery right to your door, like eventually became. I had a full-blown tantrum. And mind you, I'm in my 30s at this point in my story. So I remember my partner was there. I was screaming. I was crying. I probably broke something. You know, I was just pacing all, thrashing through the house, just having a full-blown tantrum because I couldn't get a hold of supply and I had run out. And it at this point in looking back, I'm like, man, I can't even believe that and I still kept going, you know. And I think I knew that I had an addiction. I don't think that was it. Like I said, my dad was an alcoholic, and I actually grew up going to Al-Anon, Al-Anon. I came up through Al-Anon, Al-Anon, Al-Anon. And so I knew that I had an addiction, and I always said, I have bigger fish to fry. I have bigger fish to fry. And what I used as my free pass, so to speak, or my, I don't use the word trigger very much, but something that used to just make me feel that I had a kind of blank check to just act all kinds of sideways was my righteous indignation. Righteous indignation was and still is probably my Achilles heel. Because I didn't have a sense of my inherent worth. And that has been an immense gift of my recovery, is that I no longer feel that I am what I do, or what I do for money, or what I do, just how I spend my time, or what I am on paper, or what I give back to my community. You know, there's a lot of martyr syndrome going on there. And so by working in this really rough environment, and by defending folks below the poverty line, largely people of color, and fighting against the state, that just, again, it was my excuse to just live my life really angry and really sick and really sad and ultimately really high. And in that field, and I will move on and here to the to the hope part, but just so you really get a picture of what it was like. And in my field, that kind of sick and sad, like we say in the rooms, was really normalized. Whether it was pot, whether it was alcohol, that was probably the biggest one, whether it was caffeine, whether it was just that really poisonous righteous indignation, it was everywhere. It was all around me. And it was a transformative part. It was probably the first step in my recovery, actually, before I was sober, to, I'll say, get myself out of there. But what actually happened was I had a full-blown breakdown. So breakthrough, we can call it, in 2016. I went out on long-term disability, and I had a real reckoning with the universe, still smoking the whole time. Went back to work eventually, and then I thought, well, now that I know that I feel like I have some tools as to how to do this, then became the question of, but do I want to? And I didn't have the self-belief that recovery has given me, and what weed did for me was it allowed me to self-medicate to the extent that I didn't have to actually make the changes in my life that I needed to make. So I wish I had kept a little bit better time here. I think this is quite a long, I think this meeting offers a generous amount of time, so I'll just have plenty of time for my next chapter here. So back to work, left again. You know, luckily I was in a union, so I took sabbatical. I lived on an ashram for 9 months. Let me tell you, the whole time I lived on that ashram, I'm doing yoga, I'm washing dishes, I had a spiritual, really robust spiritual practice that I've been building for a couple of years, but probably since my breakdown/breakthrough in 2016. By the time I was on sabbatical and was actually living on that ashram was 2019. And the whole time I was there, I was still smoking weed. I would do, you know, go and sit and meditate and do my whole thing. And with whatever little bit of energy I had left, I'd go out and I'd hotbox my car, or I'd go for a long walk, even if I was so tired from all the labor I was doing, because I was doing like a work exchange, basically, to live on the ashram in exchange for the day's work, you know. And I would go for a walk and just do anything I could to smoke weed. And I still kept doing it. And it was, you know, the pandemic eventually hit. I was living out the end of sabbatical with my mom. And my mom had me at 41. And so she, like I said, I just celebrated my 40th birthday. She just celebrated her 80th birthday. So, you know, I was having these wild fights where my emotions were just so dysregulated, largely, I believe, now as a result of my using, at the very least, as a result of not having, again, the self-belief that this program has given me to take the steps I needed to take to tend to my needs. My mom was not really emotionally available growing up, and certainly was not emotionally available when we were living together, and really isn't today. But now our relationship is actually so much wildly improved, because something else this program has given me is, you can't get blood from a stone, you know. And one of the beautiful signs of my own emotional sobriety, and I'll talk a little bit more about what that term means really, you know, clearly, but one of those things for me is when I am looking for emotional validation or inspiration or support, I don't go to the stones. I don't go to my mom to share something that is very important to me and my value set. But if it's outside of her value set, I'm not going to get the response that I need. I don't, that, you know, she doesn't have the skills to relate on some of those deeper levels that I've really, really, really enjoyed in my recovery. The whole flavor and tenor and richness of all of my life relationships has changed. And so finally, after I had done I'd reckoned with the universe, I'd taken time off work, I'd done I got a psychiatrist, I got a psychologist, and I was still sick and sad, and I decided to try EMDR therapy. And with EMDR therapy, I had to look really hard to find a practitioner that, that's a kind of therapy that works really well, for those that don't know, for post-traumatic stress disorder, which is something that I struggle with. And my therapist said to me, well, look, this modality is going to work a lot better if you can just try to not smoke for 24 hours before our sessions and for 24 hours after. And that's it. It's, you know, she had no judgment. She wasn't like, oh, you're an addict, stop. You know, she didn't tell me to stop smoking weed, but she just explained, like, this is going to work better, you know, in this way. And I said, sure, no problem. Well, turns out it was a problem. It was a big problem, and I couldn't do it. I came back and I told my therapist I couldn't do it. I said, well, have you ever tried a Marijuana Anonymous meeting? And I said, a what? You know, even though I had grown up with program feeling like all around me, it didn't even occur to me that MA was a thing. And so I'm extremely, extremely grateful that my therapist, you know, was so unassuming with me, because like any addict, you know, if she were to have told me, well, you should really do this, I probably would have needed to do my own research, right? Even though I had plenty of data, if someone, would have tried to tell me what to do at that stage, and even now, of course, I don't like it. but at least now I know I don't like it, and I have cultivated through my daily practices and through this program and through all the work that I do with myself an awareness, almost like watching myself in a movie, I sometimes will even refer to like my small self, my little self, like small S versus big self, capital S, which is, I'm meaning like my higher self. I still didn't go, by the way, still didn't go to a meeting. I moved back eventually, my sabbatical ended, and I moved back to New York, and I settled in the small town where I live now, and I promptly got COVID around New Year's of 21, and when I was in isolation, I looked around, and I really had no one to call, to call for help, to bring me groceries. And again, I started to feel real sorry for myself. That's another big, that one's right up there with righteous indignation for me, is when I start to feel sorry for myself. That's a huge red flag. That's what I used to really like to get high about also, because I didn't like the very few people that I had around me. I had like one or two, intimates that I would, that were long distance. I called my ex-wife, for example, and said, yeah, I have COVID. And I realized I was just sort of managing her anxiety about my being sick, and then I told my mom, and I was managing my mom's anxiety about being sick. And I told one other friend, and they had a really morbid, very enthusiastic curiosity, morbid curiosity, because of course I was one of those that lost my sense of smell and my sense of taste, and actually ended up getting long COVID and had I struggle now with chronic fatigue syndrome. I had all of the neurological stuff. It was a rough road for me, but anyway, that was kind of my rock bottom, and that's when I got into the room. And what did I say? 3 years, 2 months, and 3 days ago, I quit pot and really haven't looked back since. I think the only reason that I haven't relapsed is because I never want to go through that freaking process ever again. That was so difficult for me. I had the shakes. I had the sweats when I was detoxing. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I was nauseous. I was taking like 2-3 showers or baths a day. I ritualized my taking of baths. I said I was going to divinize my whole life. It was the only way that I could demarcate time outside of the rolling of joints. I was always a joint roller. And so that motion with my hands, I would roll joints until, my fingers became arthritic and I had to ice them, it was like that. And so I had to find new ways of being and new ways of making meaning of my life. And let me tell you, for the first year or so, I didn't even know what gave me joy. But I threw the spaghetti at the wall and I tried to see what stuck. I rode horseback. I started roller derby. I was knitting. I was cross stitching. By the way, that knitting kit is still in my closet somewhere. The knitting, like, not everything stuck. You know what I mean? What else did I do? I mean, I was in book club. I was in basically anything to have connection as the opposite. They say connection is the opposite of addiction. And that was so true for me. And it still is. Even just the other day here, a buddy of mine came to visit, a fellow actually. I go exclusively to online and, you know, meetings. I've never been to an in-person MA meeting. And so I met a fellow who I'd known in the rooms for like 2 years. They happened to be on a road trip and said, hey, I'm going to be near your area. And we linked up. And let me tell you, that connection was like mana, what do they say, mana from heaven. That's not in my tradition, right? But it really fed my soul. And it always surprises me how a little bit of connection goes such a long way, you know, for a stoner, especially for me. Because I used to not answer my phone. I was scared. I was scared to go outside the door. I was scared to be with anyone too long. And a big part of that was, and I say probably have probably about 5 minutes left, I would reckon. And so getting off pot allowed me to conquer that fear. And I learned how to give myself permission to screw up. And that was something that I had never had. I had never just, it was just, perfection was a big theme. I mean, you can imagine being a product of the educational industrial complex, you know, it was just, and the, you know, the kid of immigrant parents. And so perfection has been a big theme in my life. And so one of the greatest blessings of this program and of the work that I do on myself is giving myself permission to screw up, because I know now that the mistakes that I make, if they're made with integrity, right, because I'm not high, and that generally means that I'm doing my level best. And sometimes people do their level best and things still don't work out, right? People, places, things I don't have control over. And boy, I used to really like to get high about wanting to control people, places, things. But now that I kind of reckoned with my place in the universe, right-sized myself here, I just feel so free. I just feel wildly liberated. And so to approach my 40th birthday and my 1 year on testosterone, feeling wildly liberated, I mean, that's a success to me. You know, I live to tell the tale. Anybody that says they don't believe in a higher power, sometimes I think to myself, and then they'll, have you ever heard, maybe you go into a meeting and you're someone say, oh yeah, I almost died this time and this time, like me, myself, you know, I was so high one time I got on the freeway, going in the wrong direction. I have a lot of shame about that, you know, but by golly, can I not believe in a higher power having had that experience and having not killed anyone, myself included? Another expression I like about higher power is, if you don't believe in a higher power, go to the beach and tell the tide not to come in. That one really worked for me too. So anyway, I'll wrap up here, but I've been really fascinated with this expression of you. It's a line in a reading. I read a lot of spiritual texts. I practice a non-dualist spiritual tradition called Advaita Vedanta. It's basically the ancient version of yogic philosophy. And in Swami Dayananda's commentary to a particular section of the Bhagavad Gita, there was a line that said, you become stronger with every problem you face, whether you are successful or not. And that has been my rallying cry. I've moved out of New York City. I live in this beautiful area now. I live in the most beautiful home that I could have ever imagined. I'm a renter, you know, but I just have this life that even at its, on my hardest days, is still beyond my wildest dreams of what I could even conjure when I was using. I just opened my own law firm. I practice civil rights and employment law. And I'm also right now, I went into my 40th birthday on, you know, public benefit. So I'm broke as anything. But I made a decision and I've just started to do something and I've given myself permission to fail. And each month I say, gosh, I'm not sure exactly how I'm going to make my rent next month. And somehow, because of my emotional sobriety, I promised I'd talk more about that, but I think I've pretty much maxed out my time. But because of my faith, because of my right sizing of emotions, because of my ability to remain steady, because of my excellent boundaries now in sobriety, because of my willingness to ask for help, those are all parts of my emotional sobriety. Because of that, I've done this thing of starting my own business, which I never thought I could do and that I always wanted to do. And so I hope this, I hope I can just continue to give myself permission, and I hope I can just continue to put the success of something aside and just remind myself every day that we're better for the effort, you know, that I am stronger with every problem that I face, whether I'm successful or not. And of course, P.S., that's what real success looks like to me today. So thanks for letting me share. Sure.